Hello and welcome to Fueling Around with me, Jason Plater, and the olive in my martini. It's Dave Vitti.
Hello.
Now, Fueling Around is powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, you all right?
I'm very good, thank you. How are you?
Not so bad. You're looking a bit toned down today. Last week, you were client-facing in your dress.
Yeah, I've had a mixed day of meetings today. So this is a working from home outfit. So hopefully it will be applicable to our next guest. I have to say that actually, in that cap, you look a little bit like Brian Johnson.
I'm not sure how to take that. Brian's substantially older than I am, so I just.
But slightly more rock and roll. Anyway,
yes, absolutely.
Maybe I shouldn't have said it, and maybe we should fast forward on to the mainstay of today's broadcast, our special guest.
Well, our guest today is a gentleman who can only be described as purebred motor racing royalty. A Formula One legend on and off the track, it is, of course, the one and only DC David Coulthard. Hi, mate, how are you?
I'm just enjoying watching and listening to you guys, actually, so I'm slightly disappointed that I now have to speak.
It doesn't get any better than this, by the way. Normally the start is the most polished bit and then it goes dramatically downhill. But we do very much appreciate your time. You're a busy man, Mr. Coulthard. Thank you for joining us today. We're on the cusp of the new Formula One season. 2024 is about to launch in Bahrain. As a man with all the insider knowledge, what are you looking forward to most about the season ahead?
Well, having worked on and signed off on the 2024 script, I think it's an absolute belter. So I'd love to be able to share more as soon as possible. But, you know, you're just going to have to tune into the highlights package on Channel 4, or if you really insist on watching it live, our partners at Sky. But, racing's in our blood, isn't it? We like the uncertainty. We like the excitement of new season, new car. Everybody starts at the same point scoring, zero on the board as they go into the first race. And it's that uncertainty, isn't it? When they all launch new cars and they all believe, of course, they've come up with something brilliant. And we never really know until we get to the qualifying session at race one and ultimately the checkered flag. So I just love that uncertainty. It's like a night out, isn't it? You know, when you were a single man, you just don't know what to expect.
It's like a night out with Jason. You're never quite sure what's going to happen.
Right, moving on swiftly from that that little thing. But looking at the last couple of years, and particularly last year, DC, and towards the end of the season, I mean, do you honestly think the opposition can get close to Max and Red Bull? Because they were light years ahead, weren't they?
Well, not an outright single lap pace. You know, Ferrari pushed them pretty hard on a number of occasions. And that was this slightly peculiar thing about 2023 Formula One, that you could have a very close qualifying session. And a lot of them were, actually. You know, certainly the grid from top to tail is closer than when I started in Formula One. You could have like several seconds across the grid. But it's that management, isn't it? The race management and consistency, the thing that, you know, set Michael Schumacher apart from the rest when he was there. It wasn't that he was, I think, unbelievably quick over a single lap. He just was able to do those laps repeatedly that made him brilliant. And, you know, as we know through our racing knowledge and experience, that is the magic thing, isn't it, for all these greats. They just repeatedly do it, and that's where Max exploited by the tune of almost 200 points. He was ahead of Checo, who's a very, you know, a lovely, rounded individual and a fast winning Grand Prix driver, but was made to look just ordinary in comparison to what Max was able to do. But we get that on occasion, don't we? We get seasons where it's quite difficult to fully understand, but some people are just on form. And they may or may not replicate it. But I have an open mind that everyone's been able to study the Red Bull performance. The amount of data nowadays that you can get to understand where you're quicker and where you're slower. And then the resource that's available to these teams, they've got to be able to focus in that area. So, look, open mind, let's see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, you know, was it Max's car getting lifted up in the crane at Monaco? I can imagine there was 8,000 million pictures taken of the underside of that car. But all of that's relevant, isn't it? You know, everyone's spying and looking around. And as each year goes on, they do all get closer, don't they? Because they've gone down a few blind alleys. So yeah, fingers crossed it's going to be a cracker.
The thing, of course, as well, with all the photography, and there's photographers up and down the pit lane, guys that we've known throughout our racing careers, that are employed by teams to take as many pictures of the opposition as possible. Everyone's doing it. It's fair game. Yeah. It's part of the admiration of your competitors, even if it's a team at the very back. And this is one thing, actually, right, to mention on an Adrian Newey, who you know, he'll start at the back of the grid and be taking notes all the way to the front of the grid. He's not... what would be the correct word? He's not only doing top 10, because there'll be something on a car towards the back that he'll go, God, that's really clever. It obviously doesn't work as a package with the overall car, but I hadn't thought of that. And, you know, the teams can take the known sizes, you know, the Pirelli tires, the camera on the top, which is a standard part, other elements of the car, which are absolutely something you can then digitize and then somehow extrapolate out into a better understanding of the visible surfaces. And then, as Jason mentions, when you get a picture up the rear, underside of the car, then you sort of expose another element of how they're generating the downforce.
David, 24 races this year. It's going to be a busy time for all of those people like yourselves involved in F1. Is there one circuit that you particularly look forward to on the calendar, or do you just get excited about the new ones? How does it work for you when you're packing to do the big off?
I think because I've been on this world tour for 30 years in terms of Formula One, and then, you know, however many years before that in karting, and every journey was a long journey. Even Lark Hall in near Glasgow was 2 hours away. Yeah. So there was never anything close. So I've spent so much time traveling that I definitely get excited by the Grand Prix that aren't too far from the airport. The hotel is close to the track. And I just go there and enjoy the Grand Prix, the elements of that Grand Prix. And that really for me is focused on qualifying in the race, because, it's great to see cars go around, but on a Friday, you don't really know what they're doing program-wise.
Yeah.
And all of that, you know, hopes and what have you that come out of the Friday press conferences. I just love the actuality, the reality of the stopwatch doesn't lie. And that's something that even with my son karting and, I've seen some great images of Jason in karting. He was like one of the scariest looking Darth Vader helmets they had, and his number one plate and his spindly legs, you know, the cutaway and the number one plate as he squeezed himself into a car. You know, whether it's karting or whether it's Formula One and every other great championship in between, the stopwatch doesn't lie. You can either dial a lap time or you can't. And a lot of people we know do it in qualifying, but it's about dialing it over, you know, however long the race happens to be, which is where the brilliance comes out. And of course, the drivers need winning teams and cars, but normally history would suggest that the really good guys in any given formula will find their way to an opportunity at a certain point.
So talking about good guys in great cars, we've got to talk about Lewis going to Ferrari. Genuinely, was that a surprise to the world of F1?
It was certainly a surprise to me, having known Lewis since he signed to McLaren when he was 12 years old, and he was a little squeaky voiced young boy with dreams of being a Formula One driver. And then having been on that long journey through McLaren Mercedes into Mercedes, I just didn't imagine at 38 that he would cut that cord.
Yeah.
And as racing adults, we understand you know, when you sign a contract with a team, it's this beautiful marriage contract, but you have the divorce papers prepared at the same time, because you will never, whether you're a soccer player, whether you're, you know, whatever team sport it is, or a racing driver, no one stays there forever. There's always an end game, whether it's a driver being with one team for his entire career, which I just, in a long career, I don't remember. But I really admire, I've always been super impressed, of course, by Lewis's speed, and he's a clean driver. He's a winning machine. You know, there's nothing that I can say that other people can't observe in terms of just what a aspirational winning machine he is. But I think this decision above all else, some people went, it was brave to go from McLaren Mercedes to Mercedes. Well, really, was it? You know, give someone like Mercedes with all their, you know, they had a winning power unit. It was a case of bringing together the other elements. It was just a calculated risk gamble that paid off in terms of multiple titles. But to go, hey, I know I'm a Mercedes man, but actually I'm just going to go red. I'm going to be a Ferrari driver at the end of my career.
Yeah.
And they've obviously found a package that works for them. If I believe, and I've not seen it with my own eyes, but I believe that it's also supporting the, you know, the Hamilton Foundation or whatever that's officially called, which will empower, engage other, you know, other people to get involved in motorsport. I just think it's inspired. I think it's brilliant for the sport. Yeah. I think he will have a tough challenge. I've said that on another podcast I do with Eddie Jordan, which is a bit like herding cats, as you can imagine. You know Eddie, he's a nutter. But anyway, we have a little podcast. And I mentioned on there, I think that Lewis will have a big challenge with a young, motivated Charles Leclerc. And, of course, when you're a huge Lewis Hamilton fan, then instead of just accepting that somebody else can have a different opinion, they have to go, what do you know? You never won a race, or you never won a championship. You know, you're an idiot. Where I'm perfectly happy for people to have different opinions and points of view, because that's all we're debating. But it's always interesting when you get that diehard who think you're an idiot to challenge that he may find it difficult. But it's my honest view that I think Charles is one of the quickest guys over a single lap. I don't know that for a fact. It's just a belief based on he's had a number of polls. So I just think it will be a really big challenge for Lewis. And I'd be interested to know what you guys think. You know, do you think I'm barking up a tree? Or do you think...
I think you're on the button. I too think it's inspired. And I'm not sure I think brave is the right way. Like you said, it's not the right way to describe it. I think it's going to be very exciting for all of us to watch, because I agree with you that I think Charles is... He's pretty special, that lad. You know, he's not short of speed. He's certainly not short of support within the Ferrari camp. And I think maybe the unusual aspects, which are Ferrari, which have caught some greats out over the years, where they've arrived there and it's not produced what they were hoping. Maybe that's because of the way Ferrari is. Who knows? But I think it's going to be tough. But I think he'll crack it. I really do.
It's interesting when you look at his age as well, isn't it? You know, because as you say, David, you know, he's obviously looking at the end game here. Obviously, there could be, you know, a sort of greater package in terms of his foundation and stuff like that. But I suppose also at his age, it's a chance to put himself in another car and have one last final challenge, you know, really to prove how good a driver he is. You know, when you sort of had that whole debate between driver and car and driver, this is another opportunity at his age to really kind of go, do you know what? I've done it in this car.
Yeah, but what I find remarkable about that, I just can't imagine he's got any doubt. The guy is exceptional. He is ahead in every record that I'm aware of, other than world titles. But he could have been a 9-time champion. He could have won more titles. I don't think because he wins 8, I'm suddenly going to go, okay, I'll give him credit for being a really good racing driver. I think the guy's been amazing since his first year, where he equaled Fernando Alonso in points at McLaren Mercedes. I think that Fernando has played a part in his belief system, because I think we do end up, don't we, in a sort of society kind of dictates when we should be doing things until. And then you'll get the freaks of nature who go, well, actually, I don't comply. I'm going until I decide. And I think Fernando 42 outperforming Lance has made Lewis think that he can keep going. There will be a point of diminishing returns. I just, for me, those who don't like me will say I never got to a peak to ever then have the drop off in performance. But in terms of my own career, I definitely felt there was a point at the end where I just didn't have the fight in me anymore. And maybe because I had to fight harder to try and get to the level of the really exceptionals. But again, we haven't been a sport, especially at that level, that has carried drivers well into their 40s and beyond. I think IndyCar, you know, we go way back to Fangio, who was in his 40s when he won world titles. And in IndyCar, you had Mario Andretti. But I actually don't recall enough about his career to know what was his age where he won a championship. And maybe it was more oval-based racing than circuit racing. But Jason, I'm interested, you know, you're more recently a racing driver than myself. What's your view on that? What is the sort of the transitional point? Is it others looking and going, well, we should go with youth rather than the existing known talent? Or do you start to feel that the hunger isn't there anymore?
I think it's a bit of everything, but it's driven from within. I like your expression that it's the hunger. It's, am I a bit tired? Am I a bit burnt out? Am I enjoying every aspect of it? And certainly in my case, the answer to that was no. There was certain elements of it which just became a pain in the arse and just tiresome. And I think you then reach a point where you go, I'm not putting in everything which I would naturally put in. Time to stop.
Yeah,
I think. But interesting enough, you mentioned Fernando. I mean, he's just put a statement out this week where he's had some medical examinations, and they reckon he's a freak of nature and go until he's in his 50s.
Yeah, but there's a sort of self-supporting background to that, isn't there? But Fernando is exceptional. I would have him in my team. If I had one in my fantasy team, I'd definitely have Fernando. I think he's just a benchmark, and therefore, I think if that was an option to Mercedes, then assuming he's still got it in him to go to 2025, I think it would be a good final, let's say, finishing school for George. George has come up very nicely alongside Lewis in outright pace, and he'll continue to learn and grow as a driver. No question, he's a potential champion of the future. But it's going to be interesting to see what they decide to do in 2025. It opens up the driver market.
Yeah. Come on, then. Prediction for 25. Who's at Merck? Go on, you got but £10 on the nose. Who are you putting it on?
A tenner? Jesus.
Yeah, well, £8. £8.
Quid. Okay, £8. Alex Albon?
Yeah, that's a good call.
That way they could have one set of seat and pedals, because both George and him are the same size. They're both tall drivers. But I would like to see Fernando get a chance. And I'm not disrespecting Aston Martin, who are definitely on the up. And I saw Lawrence Stroll predicting they'll get a victory this year. And I think that'd be great for them, great for Formula One. But... Yeah. Let's, if we just go with our traditional last few year Grand Prix winning teams of Mercedes, Red Bull, McLaren, and Ferrari, then it'd be great to see Fernando back in there. He's unlikely to be, I guess, Red Bull, you never know. Unlikely to be Ferrari. Well, definitely not Ferrari, because they've got the driver signed up. So it only really leaves a couple of potential teams. And until Oscar's signed up again at McLaren, we know Lando's committed long term, so I guess we're waiting for Oscar to either do the same or for Mark Webber to, weave his magic and get him into another situation where he takes a step forward.
Dave, we've just been talking about sort of the mental side, I suppose, and how long you can be that sharp and go on for. But also, I mean, how important is the physical aspect? As a driver yourself, and you were one of those people who really focused heavily on your own physical fitness during your racing career, how important is it these days, do you think, to actually be physically at your absolute optimum as well as having the mental agility?
Well, I think they go hand in hand. Certainly for me, the fitter I felt, the stronger I felt in my mind, because it was a case of just believing you had left no stone unturned. And again, history shows that I could win some Grand Prix in good cars, but I couldn't overcome, my teammates who won world championships. So I accept that. I tried my best. But certainly throughout my career, I always felt I was evolving and getting stronger and fitter and more mentally aware. I'm not trying to, feel sorry for me, but I was very much a village boy till quite late in my career. And I think that village boy mentality would have probably come across as being a bit standoffish, because I wasn't really as outgoing as I then developed as I got into my late 20s and early 30s. I was just a bit worldly naive. I just came up through racing and I just didn't really know where I kind of fitted in to the whole thing. And then as you get more confidence and get, established and everything, then your personality finds its comfort zone and comes out. So I think there's definitely evolution for each of these different drivers. Some come in and they're just on it straight away, and some the slow burn. I'm always reminded of the Nigel Mansell quote from Peter Waugh, who said he would never win a race as long as he's got a hole in his arse. He went on to win 20-odd Grand Prix, a world championship, across to America, winning the IndyCar championship. You know, what an incredible race car driver he was, whether you warm to him as an individual or not. Actually, Jason, did you ever race against? Can I never race against Nigel? I shared the 94 Williams with him. I did the rest. But when he did a couple of touring car races in the UK, were you in touring cars at that time?
Yeah, I did race against him, yeah. But, I mean, there was one particular. It was his first event in at Donington Park. And it was absolutely atrocious, the weather. I mean, it was just torrential rain. And guess what? He just appeared at the sharp end of the grid.
Really?
Yeah. And you know, in practice, he was close, but a little way off. And then, first lap of the race, it was lap two. He's got himself in the lead. And it was just extraordinary. I mean, he didn't stay there. He had a bit of a shunt, I think. But I agree. God, he was bloody good. Incredibly good.
What was the difference with him? You know, I mean, he was a very different style. But what was it that made him so fast? If you can sum it up in a sentence,
just imagine what I've got in my hands.
yeah, they're massive, aren't they?
Right. Okay. Okay. Brave. Yeah. Just bravery.
When I was his test driver. I had three wonderful learning years at Williams. I was test driver for Nigel, then I was test driver for Alan, and then test driver for Ayrton briefly, sadly, before he lost his life. And, you know, my summary was Nigel had no real interest in a full day of testing. He was very interested in the glory runs in the morning, Estoril, first hour, track cold, lots of new tires.
Is that right?
Yeah, and he would just go out and such strength. And back then, the cars didn't have power steering, which anyone who's driven, you know, cars at that level will know just how difficult that makes it. And he just had brute strength and bravery. And yeah, he was aggressive in as much that you could tell he was hustling, you know, you could see the body language of the car, but he wasn't in the way of a Gilles Villeneuve or someone where, you know, it was all kind of Juha Kankanen and you know, you're wondering whether we're going to finish the lap. I really, you know, got to acknowledge just how brilliant he was.
And was it true that in the fast corners, he was just outrageously committed?
Yeah. Look, at that stage of my career and my age and my strength, I couldn't match his physical ability. And I believe, you know, talking to Adrian Newey, who worked with him through the active ride era when he was there with Riccardo Patrese, I think he qualified Riccardo at Silverstone by a second. Now, we can all have a bad day and be half a second off our teammate because of we've made a mistake or you've got terminal understeer or something like that. But a second, you know. Yes. And he was just the active car on the Williams, it was always kind of searching for its rear right height. You know, the system wasn't robust enough to be at the right height that was determined. So it really felt a little bit like a magic carpet. I remember testing it and it was a little bit disconcerting, but it did have the grip. But it was one of those things where you had to commit to the corner. And let's say, for argument's sake, back then, Copse was 160, 170 miles an hour. The actual data would tell you the car could do 170 miles an hour through there. Your gut feeling was, I think 160. He would do 172 and figure it out.
really?
Just bravery, wow.
You touched on it just before then, David. Let's go back to your early stages of your own motorsport career. You obviously came through karting, like a lot of people did, in various different race series as a young driver. Who was your hero growing up, or heroes even?
I never really had that. I was never really a sort of autograph hunter, and I never really had dreams, to be perfectly frank. And I think that's because my grandmother, who was, you know, quite an imposing individual, always used to tell me that dreaming is what you do when you sleep and achieving is what you do when you work. So I think I had kind of erased the word dreams from my vocabulary for fear of telling her it's my dream to be a driver. Yeah. So, you know, in karting, I was very much looking at where I was. so I mentioned about Jason when you know, I remember very well when he was British champion at karting, and you're looking up to the guys who are ahead of you and their achievements, and hoping that one day you can achieve that level of success. Mm. When my father, who had the vision for me to go to cars, said at the end of 88, right, we're going Formula Ford racing. I was like, why do we want to go to Formula Ford, which was the entry level? I was having a great time in karting. I was being competitive. You know, it was challenging. And when I first drove a Formula Ford, which was a Van Diemen RF 87, a snowy Knock Hill, it confirmed why I didn't want to go to car racing. It was horrible. Yeah. It was cold. It was wet. You hit a curb
no
and
grip.
The wheel would do this because of the suspension. It was just really weird sensation. But anyway, my father was insistent that I had to stick with it. And then through the support of David Leslie Jr. and Sr., they created a brilliant platform of testing. So by the time I got to the first race of 89, you know, I won that race, won 22 out of 32 races that year. And that became a springboard to go into Paul Stewart Racing that led to then all the rest. So, you know, great vision for my dad. And thankfully he didn't listen to me. Otherwise I'd still be going around Rowra or you know, Lark Hall or, you know, whatever, all those kart tracks.
Great days, those, eh? Great memories. And in fact, you mentioned it earlier with your young lad. You're back into that game again. You know, you're back karting with
I'm on the sidelines.
And what's that like, being a karting dad?
It's better now. The first couple of years, I really, really feel comfortable. It's that lack of control. You'll relate to this. When I say that, it's not that we're control freaks. We very much accept, you know, I think when you become a professional racing driver, you focus on what you can influence and what you can't influence, like regulations and things like that. You just don't waste any energy. You know, you've got so much energy in a given day. You focus it on where you can get returns, whether that's with your team, whether that's in your own performance. So I'm a fatalist in that respect. But when he was younger, I did find it uncomfortable because he's wanting to do it and you're just watching them, you know, whizzing around. And of course, you know, life has its trials. Touch wood. He seems to be, progressing through. He's in seniors now. He wants to go to cars and I will support him into that. And the rest will be down to him.
Yeah. I know what you like. I know what you're saying about those first few moments. My youngest daughter's found horses and it's nervous wreck.
Really?
Nervous. I mean, I'm better now, but I'm still, you know, I'm on iPhone. Take the video, Dad. Duty.
Yeah. It's a funny thing though, being a parent, especially when you've been in the sport. I don't really get the feeling that Dayton, he listens more to Dave Boyce, who runs him, me and karting, than he would me. I think he takes the view, it's different now, Dad. And I'm not sure it is. You know, technology is different and all that sort of stuff. But the basis of going racing, driving quickly, being consistent, all of that sort of thing, I personally don't think it's different. I think that
I agree.
The next generation should evolve, should be better. That's what you want for your children. That's what life wants for humans to evolve. It's just difficult.
It's to do with the fact that you're his dad. That's what it is. It's because you're his dad. And if, you know, and it's that thing with teenagers, young adults and whatever you say is wrong and outdated, but actually somebody else will say exactly the same thing. And it's been like, oh, that's interesting. But, you know, as dad, they're just not going to listen. David, we talked just before about Ayrton Senna in 1994. You're working at Williams as a test driver. And obviously the sad death of Ayrton Senna was what gave you your opportunity in Formula One. When you look back on that now, do you look at it differently? In other words, could you understand the enormity of that opportunity at the time, or do you see it as a far bigger thing now, if that makes sense?
Yeah, no, it makes complete sense, because I think when you're in the middle of something, and especially as a, I guess it must be the same in other sports, but obviously I only know motor racing, but when you're a racing driver, you know, it's the end of your nose and just beyond. You're very self-centered. Mm. Very much about opportunity, and you have to be focused. And it's the benefit of youth. You don't know what you don't know. And as you get older, of course, you become more aware of consequence, and you don't sort of just jump in all believing. You start to, you know, use your experience to maybe hesitate. And I think that's why in some cases you lose a little bit of performance, because you've worked through the various scenarios. When you're younger, you just see opportunity, go for it. It works, and you go, yeah, of course it works, because that's what I do. And then when it doesn't work, you blame the other guy. So it was obviously a horrible weekend. I was at Silverstone that weekend in Formula 3000. And Friday we had Rubens Barrichello have a huge crash in the Jordan. And I think he broke his arm and his nose. Saturday, sadly, Roland Ratzenberger lost his life. And then on Sunday, I was at Silverstone for qualifying, because it was the bank holiday Monday race from the 3000. And I was watching it on the Avon tire truck, because it was we didn't have mobile devices to watch these things back then. It was the only one with an aerial, and it was on the telly. And I saw the crash, and I saw the movement from Ayrton, and like everybody thought, okay, it's a biggie, but it should be okay. And then it was whatever point thereafter, the news came through. But I'd received a fax that morning. I was living in Milton Keynes with some of the mechanics who actually won. Simon Adams still works for Red Bull Racing. It was Paul Stewart Racing back then. And I received an old-fashioned paper fax from the Williams team, signed by Patrick, Frank, Ian Cunningham, who was in the marketing department, and Ayrton. And Ayrton's message was just, very best to you, knowing that I was racing and qualifying that day. And then later that day, of course, he lost his life. And then 3 weeks later, I think it was Barcelona. So the next Grand Prix was Monaco. The team only entered one car for Damon. And then I was put in the car for Barcelona. And if you'd kind of thought about it more, if Ayrton can die in that car, you know, the rest of us absolutely could. But you always just believe in yourself and take the opportunity. So even now it still feels a little bit like I was detached from it. And I think that's our safety mechanism. We see danger in a different way. And I'm sure, Jason, you can relate to this particularly, in that I don't think that we are risk takers per se. You know, I think that we weigh up based on feel, based on engineering, shared knowledge. And I'm not an engineer, but I've worked with engineers who tell me what the adjustment should do aerodynamically and what the effect that should be on car. So we trust them. Yeah, absolutely. And trust and weighing up consequence, and then just basic seat of the pants feel. It doesn't matter if it's a kart when you're 11 years old, or you know a Grand Prix car when you're in your mid 30s. Adhesion is adhesion. Seat of the pants tells you whether it's the front that's sliding and you're going to crash looking at the accident, or whether it's the rear that's sliding and you're not going to see the accident until it's all over. You know, you feel that.
Yeah, it's a search for the limit, isn't it? And the closer you are to the absolute limit, and that means by not going over it too much, the more you hover on the pinhead, that's where the ultimate performance is. So of course you try and be on that spot all the time. So actually, it's never I can't think of any other than one or two occasions where it's a step into the unknown, because it simply isn't. It's just a little feel here. I mean, in fact, the only time I can was, you know, they introduced qualifying tyres in BTCC, in fact, when I was at Williams. And we couldn't use them before qualifying. So we had no data. And say, Druids at Alton Park was another gear on the qualifying tyre.
Wow.
And that was, and you had two laps. Well, in fact, you had one lap.
Yeah.
So you just had to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's probably the only time where it is a step into the unknown, where you're going over your normal race day tyres by a considerable amount. But even then, that was pretty calculated, like you say, because you get the intel and the evidence from the engineers and what a tyre can do, and it's a trust thing.
Well, surely it all comes down to preparation, doesn't it? And you're saying that you don't regard yourself necessarily as being a risk taker. I suppose that is putting all of the value into the preparation, thorough preparation, personally, and also as a team and all of those analysts and mechanics and everything that you rightly trust. And only then, I guess, can you take that calculated risk, if that's the right word, you know, to do what you do and do what you do it to the absolute limit.
Yeah, I cared. I cared a lot because this was my thing.
Yeah.
You know, if I wasn't a racing driver, I probably would have worked in the family transport company, but not as a truck driver, because I wouldn't have had the attention span to do 8 hours or however long they have to do behind the wheel. You know, I did Le Mans once, and I just came away with the greatest respect to that amazing event. It's just too long. I do not want to drive for 24 hours. So, you know, I think you've got to know where you fit in. But I just, while we were talking there about the sort of seat of pants and how somebody feels where the limit is, I wonder if the very best racing drivers across whatever discipline it is, whether it's rally, whether it's, you know, ovals, whether it's touring cars, whether it's Formula One, karting, whether they would be very good at doing like tightrope walking, where you know, that just really feeling very quickly where the balance point is out. Do you understand where I'm going with that? Just so in tune to their inner ears, because if we accept that it's not about bravery in our sport, it's not like jumping out of an aircraft without a parachute and meeting the parachute halfway down. that's brave as well as skilled. Yeah. You know, we know what it feels to be in a race car. So do you think that could that be a science project? We get the very best, stick them on the top of a high wire.
I guarantee you one thing. I've got flat feet, so I can't possibly be that bloke. I'm not getting on a tightrope. But yeah, maybe so, yeah. I mean, because you are in tune. You know, when you're on the limit in any car or a kart, anything, it's a feel, and it's a dance. You've got to keep the thing in, you know, balanced, and
it's fine
and
margins,
you feel it with
it?
Your bum. Yeah, it is. Yeah. So who knows? That's a project we should maybe look at. I tell you what, DC, what we've not spoken out about, we've spoken about, you know, racing, all the rest of it. But what about just normal road cars? Can you remember the first car you got? What was it?
So my first car that I had access to was actually a Mercedes 508D van.
Yes, okay. The karting van.
The karting van.
Yeah, yeah.
And even though I think I was already in Formula Ford, and I was still driving around in the karting van. And then I think I was close to 18 before my dad very kindly bought me a little Renault 5 GT Turbo. And was I the man?
First car.
I bet.
Yeah. Well, I was almost 18 though. So I spent a year in a van with top speed 70 miles an hour. But it had bunk beds on the back, so I was.
Really, I was going to say the van had some benefits though.
Yeah, so going on the countryside, if you were going to house parties, you know, it was brilliant. But little Renault 5 Turbo, and I actually bought one about 15 years ago to do a walk down memory lane, and drove it around Scotland, around the village and the back streets, and I thought this thing is horrible, you know. it was no soundproofing, but it just shows when you're in a teenager, it's just, you know, I used to drive it very quickly.
And did you ever fire it off?
Yep, I ended up in a ditch, got pulled out, but still made it home in time for lunch, so that was okay. I didn't shunt that properly. Yeah, I just got a bit on a gravel in a junction and slid down the side of the banking. then I borrowed my mum, had a BMW 318i, which my dad bought from Bert McNish. Alan McNish, father, had the Cross Flags garage in Dumfries, which was only 30 miles away. So my dad had a 7 Series, my mum had a 3, and I borrowed it to go to Milton Keynes. Was moving some things down to stay in Milton Keynes to drive for Paul Stewart Racing. And unfortunately, I tried to mate it with Ford Granada halfway between Scotland and Milton Keynes. And I had to phone my parents and say, your car's a little bit shorter. So that was slightly embarrassing, but anyway, these things happen when you're young.
What else is in the early days car history then? Obviously, we've had the Renault 5 Turbo, we've had the 318. Where does it go after that? What are the early movements?
Being very lucky and being with Paul Stewart Racing, although I was living in rented accommodation with mechanics, paying £50 a week, which was the smallest room in the house. I literally didn't have a pot to piss in personally, but Ford, who Jackie had a long relationship with, they at that time were launching the RS2000, and Jackie convinced them they needed a young driver who was in Formula 3 to be part of that whole launch process. So I went around the UK with Ford, when you used to do press launches to the various motoring journalists. So out of the back of that, I got the use of an RS2000 for a period of time, which was a nice Scottish blue. Other nationalities are available, but it was the one. And then sometime thereafter, they brought out the Escort Cosworth with the rear wing on it that looked like it could be strapped to a jumbo jet. And I got use of one of those. Actually, I had two of them because the first one got stolen from outside the cinema in Milton Keynes. I went into the cinema feeling $1 million, came out, and there was some broken glass on the ground where my Escort Cosworth used to sit. And then, of course, I don't know if they ever found the car, but they gave me another one, and I used that for a while. So, I was quite lucky early days. I had the car to suggest that I was earning money, but I literally was going was a lot of boiled rice and cheap tinned, whatever it was, when in the evenings.
What about the current everyday motor or the fleet? Are you someone who's spent their life going fast and now you appreciate comfort, or do you still like something with a bit of poke?
No, I've been a Mercedes guy forever. My dad, apart from that brief moment with the two BMWs, he was always a Merc guy. So, Mercedes, I bought in 1995 when I was racing for Williams Renault, a 280 SL Pagoda, which 1971, beautiful. Same age as myself. And I actually had the chance to buy a Gullwing from the Classic Center that had been fully restored. It was 120,000. And I remember the reason although I could have afforded it out of my Williams salary, I didn't know how I could tell my parents I'd just spent on an old, because classics weren't looked at in the same way back then. They were very much, for the individual to enjoy. They weren't seen as an investment model. So I paid 30,000 for the 280 SL. And I remember I turned up at the British Grand Prix in it. My mum and dad were going, "What the bloody hell's that?" And I go, "Well, it's a 1971 280 SL. And they're like,
"It's a classic.
What do you want that for?" So, anyway, I still have the car today. I think it's probably worth about 35,000. Whereas the Gullwing.
No, substantial. I had one when I was down in the south of France, and I had it nicked. And it was, I love it.
Yeah.
I loved great it. Cars. And I wish I still, I wish I still had it now.
Beautiful. Well, the Gullwings are worth over $1 million. And let's say it's worth, $100,000. But I always said, I've kept the car since then. I take it out once or twice a year, and I always said that it would be for my firstborn. As it happens, I've only had one born, so I have a son, Dayton, and when he's of age, I'll give the car to him, and I think he'll make more use of it than I do, and I know because we go driving in it together. He's got actually in Monaco and in the south of France, you can drive an electric vehicle at 14, so he passed the driving test. Yeah, so he's 15 now. He's got one of the little Citroen, I think it's called Iamis or something like that. Have you seen?
I know what you mean. It's like a cube. It looks like a cube.
Yeah, it looks like a cube. Have you seen on social media where a guy rolls it on its side in Monaco?
Coming down the hill.
At the Lowe's hairpin. Now,
Citroen Ami.
It's like Ami, there you go. So my son has one. And so he's lucky enough to have motorbikes and buggies in Scotland. Yeah. He races carts and he's got one of these Citroens. So I've obviously done the fatherly thing where I've eyeballed him and said, "You've seen what happens if you try and drive it quickly around a hairpin. Yeah. If you crash this car, that's it. You're not getting a car until you're 17. No second chances. This is a gift.
I like your style. That's a good plan.
This is a gift to you as someone that lives in a place where you're allowed to drive at that age. And I've got to say, the poor guy, even when I've been in the car with him, if the speed limit's 30, he's doing 28.
Oh, it's really resonated then. Excellent.
I'm like, we can go. No, Dad, I am sticking to the speed limit. And this is for 2 years. And I think it's great, actually, but especially around a place like that with there's trucks that, because there's so much construction, there's buses, there's pedestrians, there's bicycles. He's really learning up to a speed. He can only do, I think, 45 kilometers an hour. It just will make them better road car drivers by the time they're 17.
Yeah.
And what about you and electric then, David? Obviously, you know, your son has the benefit of being able to drive one in Monaco because of his age, but is it something which you have done? Would you do? What's your stand on them?
I've got a couple of electric things. One's a toothbrush.
The other one sounds like a toothbrush.
The other one sounds like no, I had a Mercedes EQC, and look, they're impressive. Their acceleration, things like that. One thing that was notable to me, because my regular car is, I've got a GLS 63 AMG. It's a big seven-seater. Yeah. You can get a cart on the back. I like the big vehicles. I like the comfort. Mm-hmm. I like the space of having the option where if you've got a number of friends, you can get suitcases in the back. So brilliant for me, a brilliant all-round car. And it's got a bit of performance if you want. Obviously, it's not going to, you know, beat hot hatches and things like that, but I don't need that. But I think that, you know, the whole performance of electric, the fun element for me wore off quite quickly in terms of acceleration. I noticed the extra weight in stopping, because if your brain is tuned to a sort of distance and stopping from a certain speed, you've got to recognize you've got a lot more weight in that electric vehicle. And also, it had a range of 300 odd kilometers at that time. But the way I wanted to drive it, the range was probably just over 200. And I don't want, you know, it's a little bit like anything in life, people dictating how you should live. Now, you can make the range of these vehicles if you follow the rule book and do all the things that they suggest. But how about you want to be yourself, and how about you want to drive within the speed limit, but get to the speed limit at a sensible pace and all that sort of thing? I had to plug it in every night. And my petrol or my diesel, I've got a diesel here in the UK, which I know people frown at in many ways nowadays, but it, you know, with the blue tech and everything, it's incredibly clean and efficient, and I can do 700 odd miles in my vehicle. I can go up, I can go from Chelsea, where I have a place in London, to the family home in Scotland, and a decent distance back again before I have to even think about shoving a nozzle in it.
And the nozzle's in the car for 3 minutes and you're gone.
Well,
however, it's a quick turnaround, isn't it?
Fill up. I'm not going to get my hands dirty. Come on.
Hey, so where do you think we are? Because obviously you've got some intel of F1. Where do you think we are with synthetic fuel?
Well, there's already an element of synthetic fuel into the mix that we have today. 2026, I think it's already stipulated. It's 100% biofuels. And then Formula One has a target 2030 net zero, which I no doubt it will meet, because, you know, in motor racing, targets are set. People don't go, nah, that's too difficult. They go, right, thinking cap. This is going to take a bit of, you know, brain power and resource, and they get there. So Formula One, motor racing as a whole, drives change to the automotive industry. This isn't, you know, the old cliche, win on Sunday, you know, sell it on Monday. I don't think that works so much nowadays, just the way the world is. But there's no question technology transfer. We've got the most fuel efficient, you know, hybrid engines in Formula One. And that will have an effect for Audi and Mercedes and Ferrari and Honda and all these different people. So, yeah, there are solutions. There is no reason why we can't still be using internal combustion engines. They're less environmentally damaging in terms of not taking resource from the ground. They're more fuel efficient in terms of refueling per journey. There's so many positives about the internal combustion engine, which just gets lost into politics and people stipulating that you can't do this and you can't do that. It's the truth is very often different from the political play or the sales pitch. But it will come out. The truth always comes out in time. Yeah. Yeah.
So to that end, then, you see Formula One and Formula E existing hand in hand, or sort of side by side, rather, for the foreseeable future, i.e. Formula One isn't going to kind of like swallow up Formula E with, you know, all cars going electric.
No, look, Formula E, and I think what Alejandro Gag and his team have done there has played a huge part in accelerating change, and it's given an opportunity to, you know, look at the driver lineup in Formula E.
Yeah,
there are a lot of highly talented drivers. If they were all sort of put into a Formula One, let's say the entire Formula One grid walked out and said, we're done, and you put all those drivers, you would have a brilliant world championship. It's really great. Where you're not comparing apples with apples, of course, is that as human beings, although we will be entertained by lots of forms of motor racing, there's still an aspiration globally to watch the fastest form of racing, and that's Formula One. You know, I like watching touring cars, I like watching MotoGP, I like watching, you know, rally, you know, anything that involves a bit of speed and competition, then I will watch. And in many cases, other forms of motorsport are closer and more entertaining. If you're looking for just pure excitement of not knowing what's about to happen, you know, karting is a great example of that. But it's not the fastest, and it's not the most technologically advanced, and therefore it doesn't command the global audience.
So, Dave, look, we ask this question to everyone because we think it's you know, music and cars are particularly suited, and they go brilliantly together. So, imagine you've got a fantasy drive. We want to know, where are you, where are you going, what you're listening to, and most importantly, what car are you in? It could be anywhere in the world.
Well, I still think I'd go for comfort over a high-performance car. I do, because if I really want to enjoy the drive, and the modern world, you're not going to rag a high-performance car on open roads now. Just risk is not worth it. So, I did a drive recently from Monaco up to Courchevel, you know, so through along the Italian coastline, you know, nice wiggly road to Geneva, across to Turin, up into the mountains, through the Mont Blanc, and then, you know, continue the wiggles up to there. And, you know, I was driving with my girlfriend. She's got her playlist, which is a younger, funkier playlist than I would probably have on. But I like everything from, like, you know, reference, you looking like Brian Johnson. You know, I've been to concert. I, you know, I like, you know, I've been to see Iron Maiden in concert. Coldplay. You know, I like a bit of Take This. I mean, Take That. you know, like, it's like I just have such a varied. But for me, it's about not only the beat, but it's about the lyric. I like a little. I like a song with a story. I like buying into the little story they're telling us. And if you've got a, you know, a great hook, and you've got a wee storyline, you know, whether she's, you know, shook her all night long or whatever it happens to be, that's where I get engaged with the music.
Well, I think it's a nice image, Jason, and I can see you and I in Courchevel at the end of that wiggly journey, right, as DC turns up, and we'll be looking. Remember in Dumb and Dumber, do you remember the film where they have all the ridiculous ski gear? We'll be a bit like that, there for the après-ski, ready with a couple of gin and tonics or a glue vine.
As long as you haven't got your tongue stuck on the lamppost.
And on that note, Jason, I think you need to take us out.
Right, well, on that note, that is us for this week. Thanks for listening to Fueling Around, powered by Adrian Flux. As the UK's largest specialist insurance broker, Adrian Flux will tailor a quote to your exact needs and help save you money on your car, your bike, or even your home insurance. Dave, as always, thanks to you, but a huge thanks to our special guest this week, the one and only DC, Mr. David Coulthard.
Thank you, gentlemen.
David, it's been brilliant. Thank you very much indeed, and safe travels on the F1 season this year. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on Twitter at Jason Plato or at David Vitti. And if you've liked what you've heard, feel free to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button, and share the podcast on all your socials.
Thanks for listening, folks, and we'll see you next time. Ta-da!